Hi, everybody. I'm Beatty Combretos, and welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And I think that now more than ever, we all need people. We all need honest, trustworthy people who we can talk to. I mean, when you think about what has gone on in the last number of months with the pandemic, people losing their jobs, losing their businesses, homeschooling their kids, which of course impacts their being able to work, stress on relationships, concerns about healthcare. What if I get sick? And the issues go on and on and on. And of course, these things are over and above the normal issues that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. You know, for example, I look at the statistics every week when I'm preparing, you know, for the show. 350 million people worldwide suffering from depression, 16 million adults in the United States, which translates into 1 in 5 Americans suffering from depression, 40 million adults who are dealing with a variety of anxiety disorders. It's a tough, tough time in this country with racism and income inequality and concerns about what is going to be happening to our country. Hopefully, the people of the United States are going to vote out our president so that we can get on a more normal kind of a path and eliminate all the toxicity. And of course, not all the toxicity, a lot of the toxicity that we have been dealing with in the last 4 years. You look at the suicide attempts by young people. You know, I look at these statistics and they're mind-boggling. Quadrupled over the past 6 years. Since 2011, there's been a 40% increase nationally for self-poisoning by young people. The suicide rate for young people between the ages of 10 and 24 increased by 56%. The homicide rates by intimate partners increased by 26% from 2010 to 2017. 4 women are killed every day by their partners. The divorce rate for first marriage is 48%. For second marriage is 67%. 74% people end up in the divorce courts if they marry 3 or more times. So the people are definitely struggling. And we all do need to give ourselves permission and reach out and ask for help when life really starts to feel just so out of control. What we're looking at now, the mental health helplines are surging. And of course, I see that as a good thing, that people are giving themselves permission when they're feeling bad, when they're feeling lonely, to reach out to mental health helplines. And hopefully the people on the end of the helplines are people who are able to listen and be constructive. 52% of those now working from home are feeling more and more anxious and isolated. And what we're finding, too, is that alcohol sales have jumped, with spirits up 75%, wine up 66%. Cannabis has reached an all-time high. People have been exercising less and eating more. And hopefully this is going to be changing as things are opening up more and more. But of course, now we're hearing that many of the states have opened up too quickly, and they have gone from phase 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, and that are now having to really reconsider closing down the states, closing down the impetus that they thought was going to help to move things forward. So it's a very, very challenging time for all of us. And yet there are things, you know, I was talking to a patient of mine yesterday, and we need to be able to differentiate between the things that we have absolutely no control over, i.e. what President Trump is going to say or not say at a press conference, and the things that we actually do have control over. And of course, Gary Noe, he talks about this every single day, the importance of paying attention to our diets, the plant-based diets, the fruits, the vegetables, the grains, the fish, the nuts, making sure that we get enough sleep, making sure that we exercise, that we do weight training or yoga or meditation or massage or acupuncture or taking a bath, anything at all that is going to be in our best interest, not in our worst interest, to help us feel less stressed and less anxious so that we can really embrace our life. And of course, having supportive people in our life. You know, we talk a lot about toxins in our foods, chemical toxins. And of course, when I talk about toxins, of course, I also talk about chemical toxins, but I primarily talk about toxic people and how we have to make sure that we can eliminate as best as we possibly can. And that means friends and family, people who make us crazy, people who are unsupportive, people who are critical, people who are absent, people who are not there for us in really tough times, and also in good times. So we need to really take a look at our lives. And of course, I say this every single week, you know, on a weekly basis, and just see, you know, are we living our lives in positive ways? And if we find that we are doing things that are not in our best interest, and I think it's important to be aware as you go throughout your days, the things that you are doing, are they constructive? Are they self-destructive? Are they destructive? And if you are not sure, then I think it is really important to get a second opinion. You know, a lot of people find, too, that journaling is really, really helpful. If you don't have somebody that you can pick up the phone or that you can email or text, at least to find a way to release your feelings of anger, your feelings of hopelessness, your feelings of joy, your feelings of upset, to be able to get it out. Because one of the worst things that we can do for ourselves mentally and emotionally and also physically is keeping in our feelings. You know, one of the best things certainly that I have found in my life is getting a dog. Great company. What a wonderful, wonderful way to meet people and socialize. And if you don't have any one-on-one friends or family that you can really count on, support groups like a 12-step program can be very, very helpful and hopefully very, very supportive as well. But one of the things that I really wanted to address today is the importance of finding trustworthy people who you can talk to, particularly if you are needing and if you are seeking professional help. I thought a lot about the show that I did last week, and that was with Ginny Brown, who wrote a book with her daughter, Jean Brown, The Sweet Life, How We Lived After Kirby Died. And for those of you who have not yet gone to the archives to listen to the interview, it was quite an interview and quite a story about her daughter, Kirby, who went to a 5-day spiritual warrior seminar in the Red Rock Canyons in northern Arizona. And of course, this was led by no one other than Oprah's New Age guru, James Arthur Ray. People paid $10,000 each for a 5-day experience. There were 50 people who were there. And Kirby, unfortunately, was murdered. What went on there was absolutely unbelievable. Everything that you would never want to have happen, water and food were not given to the people. And of course, he was considered to be a guru. And, you know, when you have influencers, particularly people like Oprah and celebrities who are saying this person is the best, we sometimes forget the importance of doing our own assessment. Because these days, and if you think about it, many people consider themselves experts. There are expert coaches and counselors and matchmakers and relationship experts and lifestyle gurus. And how important it is that we are so careful who we are going to trust with our lives and with our relationships. And there is no shortcut. In fact, just before the show, I received a text, and this is what the text said. It said, lose over 90 pounds in 5 weeks. Fortunately, I don't have any weight that I need to lose. And this was endorsed by no one other than Kelly Clarkson, Blake Shelton, Jonah Hill, Khloe Kardashian. So I actually Googled because I wanted to find out what this miracle, in quotes, diet was all about. And so I Googled nutritionist reviews about this particular diet. So according to the professionals, according to the science, this particular diet was rated the lowest ranked diet overall. So because an Oprah, because a Kelly Clarkson or a Blake Shelton or a Khloe Kardashian or a movie star is saying that this product or this diet or this therapist is the greatest in the world, please do not be taken in. And I think that we've all been conned in some way because we're looking for beauty products and supplements as an example that are going to promise us eternal youth. We really want to believe that there is going to be a cream or there is going to be a treatment that is going to reverse the aging process. But the reality is that there is not. In fact, a couple of weeks ago here in New York City, I saw that there was a salon that was advertising $1,200 to $1,500 haircuts. Now, really, I mean, if you have unlimited amounts of money, you may not really care if you're going to be spending $1,200 or $1,500 on a haircut. But believe me, I am sure and I know that there are many, many, many hairdressers around the country who are able to give wonderful haircuts where you are not spending $1,500. So when we look at the self-help industry, and I was really surprised to read some of these numbers, it is a $13 billion industry, okay? It is a business. And that is not to say that there are not good coaches and good therapists and good matchmakers and good lifestyle gurus and good relationship experts. But, you know, I've often said is that most of us, we tend to spend a lot more time researching and assessing the grams of fat in our food and what kind of an air conditioner, what kind of a cell phone, or what kind of a computer we should buy than we do the people in our lives, which is why, of course, and for those of you who've been listening to the show now for the last several years, and today is the 305th Ask Beattie show here on the Progressive Radio Network. You know, when I wrote the book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. What I did, and I wrote the book for my daughter, Jordana, I wanted people to have the tools, to have the assessment tools, to be able to evaluate and assess who's right for you and who is wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. I think it's very easy to look at somebody and say, oh, this person is terrific. This person is trustworthy. This person is nice. And I have to confess that before I did the book, I probably, when I think back, it's a little embarrassing to even share this with you, but I don't think that I took this assessment process when it came to assessing who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship, you know, all that seriously. You know, I think for most of us, we want closeness, we want romance, we want love, we want a relationship, and it's very tempting to just bypass the process of really getting to know somebody and finding out who somebody is and who somebody is not. And before I did my research and before I wrote the book, probably like you, I would meet somebody, a man or a woman, and if I liked them, I'd say I met this really nice person. But I would never make that kind of a statement today. All I could say, the very, very best that I could say, is that I met somebody who appears, and that is the word, my friends, who appears to be nice and honest and trustworthy and smart and successful. All I can really say is that it's going to take me a while. And what was very frustrating for me, because people who know me in my personal life, I'm probably one of the most impatient people that you could ever want to meet. Professionally, of course, I'm very, very patient. Is that my research found that it takes about a year to go through this assessment process and find out who somebody is and somebody is not. So there's not a shortcut, and we really do have to be aware of the ingredients that go into a healthy relationship. And we have to also really be aware of all the red flags that probably are just standing in our way, that are looking at us, but that we may not really know if this behavior is acceptable. If this behavior is not acceptable, maybe I'm overreacting, maybe I'm underreacting. So relationship education, of course, is really key, because it keeps us safe. And that is really, really the bottom line. You know, something else that I was looking at just before the show, when I'm looking at the domestic violence statistics, and as I, you know, said before, four women are killed every single day, yes, every single day by their intimate partner, and that the homicide rate by intimate partner has increased by 26%. From 2010 to 2017. So for me, the question is, what are we doing in this country to provide people with preventative, yes, not just crisis intervention, but preventative relationship education, preventative domestic violence awareness education? So I happen to Google, and that's one of the really positive things about having the computer and having the internet. So I was very, very curious, how much money is spent federally on dealing with the effects, on dealing with the consequences domestic violence and of childhood exposure to domestic violence? So that number is $55 billion. That's $55 billion in terms of dealing with crisis intervention and the impact that domestic violence has on all kinds of people, on children, on adults, on relationships. So then I had a few more minutes before the show was beginning, and I was very curious to find out how much money are we spending on preventative domestic violence awareness programs, on preventative relationship education programs, and we are spending very, very, very little. So one has to wonder, is this also a business? Is there something consciously or unconsciously that is going on that we prefer? And I use that word prefer because that is what is happening. When you look at the money that is being spent on crisis intervention as compared to minutes, and I really couldn't even find the data that is being spent on preventative relationship education, one wonders, what is it? What are the benefits, in quotes, to the federal government and to a lot of nonprofit agencies to having all these people in these horrible domestic violent relationships where the money is going toward crisis and where the money is going toward crisis intervention and the impact of domestic violence on everybody in every possible way, emotionally, physically, psychologically, financially. And when I think back, and this is a number of years ago, and for those of you who've been following me and following my career, know about my world and my life in Montreal. And of course, I'm Canadian and I have dual citizenship and I am married to Jim Freddos, who is an American, a born and bred New Yorker, which is really the reason why I'm here in New York. But in 1975, and this was after I completed my graduate and postgraduate education at McGill University in Montreal, I was appointed as one of three people to oversee the entire school social services program for Greater Montreal. So I had a large staff. I had a number of schools that I was responsible for. Actually, there were hundreds of schools that the three of us were responsible for. But we had carte blanche. So we had counseling, all the children who needed counseling, who were either acting out or who were withdrawn or who needed psychological counseling. We were able to provide school social workers who were in the schools on a regular basis, not once a month, not once a year, not every other month. We were there on a regular basis. So that clearly no child was really left behind. We made home visits. We went to people's houses. We worked together as a team, the nurses, the psychologists, the vice principals, the teachers. And at that point, I remember I had an idea, and I was just in my mid-20s, and I thought that it was really important to teach the kids about healthy relationships. So I basically had carte blanche to do what I wanted to do. So I designed a relationship education program, and I remember I went into the classrooms beginning at the first grade level, and I remember playing Marlo Thomas's record, you know, Free to Be You and Me, and we talked about what do you do when you feel mad? And what do you do when you feel sad? And how do you handle a situation when somebody hurts you, or when somebody hits you, or when somebody kicks you? So that relationship education, it is not something that all of a sudden when we are an adult that we are supposed to know. Because the fact is that unless you were lucky, and it really does boil down to luck, to grow up in a family where you saw functional relationships, where you saw people communicating well, where you saw people that were respecting each other, that had the skills, the basic skills of how to problem solve, where people were discussing, where people, they would certainly have differences of opinion, but were compromised and trade-off, and where the family dynamic was such that people were looking for a win-win type of resolution with their partners, with their children. And the way things are these days, most people aren't lucky, and they are not seeing functional relationships and functional communication and functional problem solving, so that we're really left to our own devices to figure this all out. And when I was looking at the amounts of money, the exorbitant amounts of money that we are spending on the effects, as an example, of domestic violence, we have the money in this country to do a lot of things. We have the money for income inequality. We have the money for preventative relationship education. We have the money for single-payer health care, as we do in Canada, so that we don't have to worry. We don't have to worry about what are we going to do if we are sick and we need to go to a doctor and we don't have health care. So that there are countries, there are many, many countries around the world, of course, including Canada and Scandinavia, that are doing it a lot better than we are. And it is not about the money. It is not about the money, because the money is there. Corporations need to be taxed, and the tax money can go to these kinds of programs that we will all benefit. And it is not just for the poor people, and it's not just for the minorities, and it's not just, in quotes, for the disadvantaged. We would all benefit. And yet there is something going on, and there's something going on in this country that I am hoping, we're all hoping, or many of us at least are hoping, certainly people who are on the Progressive Radio Network, that things might shift, that there might be a change if we are smart enough to elect Biden and rid ourselves of this toxic autocrat. Again, the decision is really going to boil down to the citizens of the United States. But when people say that there isn't the money, all I can tell you is that there is the money. And if there was a will, there would definitely, definitely be the way. And I had a very interesting, it was quite an eye-opener experience that I had when I lived in Florida, when I lived in Sarasota, Florida. One day, and you may have heard the story, I received a telephone call from former Governor Jeb Bush. And I was with ABC in Tampa. I had Ask Beatty segments on the new news 3 times a week. And I know that his daughter was going through a number of difficulties with drugs. And I suspect that one of his aides probably saw me on one of my Ask Beatty segments. So how do I get a call? I get a call, and I couldn't even believe it. On a Sunday, on my voicemail, I was checking in for messages for my private practice, and here's a message from Jeb Bush. Well, to make a very, very long story short, he appointed me to the Florida Commission on Marriage and Family Support Initiatives for the sole purpose, or so I thought, to implement my relationship education program into the schools, into the high schools, and into the colleges in the state of Florida. Now, you have to understand, I had had no previous experience in the political arena. So what happened? What happened during my two-year tenure? Well, I traveled a lot around the state of Florida, and I met every single decision maker, people who really could have made a difference in terms of preventative relationship education, preventative domestic violence awareness. I met with the domestic violence gurus. I met with people in the education world. I met with the top people in social services. Of course, I had ongoing texts and ongoing emails with Governor Bush, and I was a part of a commission. I believe there were 15 of us representing different parts of the state of Florida in different arenas. So we all came to the table basically with our own agendas. And I was very naive. And I was very excited because I thought that there was going to be a really wonderful opportunity to do some good. And for me, it was not about selling books and it was not about notoriety. It was about teaching the kids at an early age how to be safe. What were healthy relationships? What is domestic violence? What do you need to do if you find yourself in a violent relationship, either emotionally or physically or sexually or psychologically? Well, I learned a lot in that two-year period. What I learned was that nobody who was at the helm of their particular areas cared at all about preventative relationship education, preventative domestic violence awareness education. And naive as I was at the time, I was shocked. The teachers cared, and I remember going to various different schools and talking to the teachers and talking to the guidance counselors, and they were really concerned because they were on the front lines. They realized the importance that children have access on a very regular basis to mental health professionals and to learn to teach the children about healthy relationships. Well, it did not happen. And I have to tell you that as far as I know, I was the only commissioner who was not reappointed after my two-year tenure because I was very vocal about all of this and money was not the issue. And then I have to tell you about another experience that I had here in New York. I happened to meet a couple of years ago with a woman from Albany who was the head of the domestic violence task force in the state of New York. And we met for lunch, we emailed, we talked, and we were discussing the importance early on of teaching people about domestic violence awareness and teaching people about what healthy relationships were and what healthy relationships were not. Well, I have to say that my experience in Florida was no different than my experience in New York. And if one more person who is at that level will try to convince me that there is no money, you know how uncommitted these people really are to making a difference in people's lives when it comes to relationships and when it comes to domestic violence. So despite the fact that, you know, we may be under the false illusion that we are bankrupt in this country and that we don't have money for these kinds of what many, many people think are luxuries, and I certainly don't believe that they are luxuries at all. They are necessities. If we are ever, ever going to change the fabric in this country, if we're ever going to change the dynamic of what is going on in the area of marriage and divorce and suicide and domestic violence, and yet you have to look back. And it's not what people say, it's what they do. And it is very, very clear to me, that people who have the power, people who have the notoriety to really make a difference, simply do not care. So hopefully when we are voting, we are going to take a number of these things into consideration when we are thinking about who do we want to represent us in the presidency, who do we want to represent us in our local areas around the country. And, you know, I'm curious, do you care about any of this? The call-in number, by the way, is 888-874-4888, because I'm really curious. What you think and what you feel about these issues. But when we come back to talking about doing your research, and we really have to do research, whether to be savvy and not assume anything and not just go to the internet and look at the stars and look at the followers and look at the likes and look at the influencers. And something that I want to say about influencers, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but influencers make a lot of money from people like you and me. Well, not me. I mean, I probably had thought about it years ago. But influencers are people who you pay. You pay an enormous amount of money for them to push your service or your product. Now, whether they do it or whether they don't do it, that actually remains to be seen. But if, in fact, you are at a place in your life where you are deciding that you really want to work with a therapist. And I certainly don't want to make it sound that there are no good therapists and no good coaches around. There are good people, but we do have to be very, very, very careful. But more and more people today are seeing therapists for a variety, of course, of emotional, psychological, and psychiatric problems. But how can you, the average consumer, know how to choose a therapist and whether or not this therapeutic process is the right one for you? And what I have found that this can literally be one of the most important decisions that an individual could make in his or her life, and it has the potential for far-reaching consequences, both positive or negative. And I would love to hear about your therapeutic experiences, both positive and negative. And again, that number, if you want to call in, is 888-874-4888. So what can you do if you have problems that you've come to a point in your life that require outside help? And for starters, and I say this over and over and over again, you need to be consumer savvy and remember to do your homework. So where do you begin? Well, you begin at the beginning. You want to get a referral from somebody that you trust. Do not be taken in by the splashy ads or likes or followers or because some celebrity is endorsing someone, okay? got to do your homework and you've got to get a referral. And that may take a little bit of doing. You may be uncomfortable. You may be embarrassed, you know, to ask, but it is a really important thing for you to do. And of course, ideally, you may want to begin with your own family physician and just say that you're looking for somebody to see somebody for therapy and who do they recommend. Now, because they recommend this person, this still may not be the therapist for you, but it's a very reasonable place to start. Now, you also need to make sure that the therapist that you choose actually specializes in your particular problem. It is not possible to be an expert in everything, so that when you meet your therapist, you need to ask a lot of questions. Number three, you need to check. Yes, you need to check online. Everything now is online, and make sure that this person's license is intact and that there are no past or pending malpractice complaints that are filed against your therapist. So again, you have some preliminary work to do. Number four, see, you have to work at all of this. It's not just about picking up the phone and calling somebody. Expect that your therapist is going to ask you a lot of tough questions about your family background, about your relationship history, about sex, previous psychiatric problems, including possible hospitalizations, suicide attempts and gestures, medications that you take, prescriptions and over-the-counter, possible addictions, traumas, sexual abuse, sexual assault, affairs, and gender identity issues. You see, this is not going to be a tea party. Though many of these questions may be difficult for you to answer, it is vital, vital for the therapist to know these facts so that he or she would be able to make an accurate diagnosis. And this is only possible if the right questions are asked and that your answers are honest. And you want to make sure that your potential therapist is on board with this process. And this kind of an evaluation and this kind of an assessment cannot be done in 30 minutes and it cannot be done in 45 minutes. So if you are seeing somebody where you have 45-minute sessions or 50-minute sessions, you know, when I grew up in Canada, I learned that 60 minutes was an hour. So my sessions are 60-minute hour sessions. It may take a couple of sessions for your therapist to ask you all of these questions and for you to feel comfortable enough. You may not feel comfortable, but hopefully, you know, comfortable enough to be able to tackle the questions and to be able to tackle the answers. And all of these questions are critical, absolutely critical, for somebody to be able to get a very, very good picture of you, of your issues, past and present. Number five, ask yourself after the first few sessions whether you are comfortable with your therapist. Now, don't expect a strong level of comfort instantly because, like any relationship, it takes time for trust to develop. And if you continue to feel uncomfortable after several sessions, you need to give yourself permission to exit the relationship and find somebody where you do feel more of a connection and where you do feel more comfortable. But everybody that I see, I mean, initially, people are scared. They really don't know what to expect. The questions that I ask are very, very probing. And it's very difficult for the majority of people to go back and look at their lives, especially if there was abuse of any kind. So this is not an easy initial process. But if you do find after, you know, two or three sessions that you are not comfortable or that there is any inappropriate behavior, you know, whether it's sexual advances or verbal, you know, verbal kinds of comments that make you feel uncomfortable, you need to give yourself permission to just get up and shut the door and walk out. Number six, does your therapist respect your time and call you back within 24 hours, including evenings and weekends, if necessary? The fact that the health insurance companies often poorly reimburse therapists and psychiatrists for outpatient mental health should not be your concern. You are entitled to sessions lasting a minimum of 50 minutes, that is according to most insurance companies, and that I find that the longer sessions work even better, and that my patients find that 2 to 4 consecutive hour-long sessions help achieve results much faster. I mean, I can tell you stories of people who I've sat with for 4 and 5 and even 6 consecutive hours in the beginning, and you really get to know the person well. And the process is really fast-forwarded. Rather than you're starting and you're stopping and you're paying and you're making an appointment for the next week. So I don't know whether or not that would be for you. And certainly the insurance companies typically do not pay for, you know, more than 1 hour at a time. But, you know, I'm just sharing with you that if it is at all possible, at least in the beginning, that the long sessions are very, very helpful to patients. Number seven, is your therapist in contact with your primary care doctor? It is important because it's necessary to rule out any physical problems or prescription medications that may be contributing or causing your problems. Because after a few sessions, your therapist should be able to tell you the diagnosis, including a treatment plan. Because I believe that anything less than weekly sessions, at least in the beginning, will not enable you to have the best possible momentum to achieve success in your therapy. And what about money? If money is the problem, I encourage you to try to negotiate your fee with your therapist or even suggest a payment plan. Remember, you need to ask for what you want. I mean, that may be an issue in your life that you've not been able to ask for what you want. But in this kind of a situation, I think it's really, really important. And remember that your therapist is not an all-knowing God or goddess. So be assertive. And I have a bias when it comes to money. I've been in New York now for about 6 years, and I hear about therapist fees, that they can be absolutely astronomical. I know people are paying $500 for 50 minutes, $350, and what I have always felt and what I have always done is that there should be enough flexibility on the part of your therapist to at least discuss a possible sliding scale. And you have to ask yourself, do you want to be with somebody? Do you want to entrust your life, your physicality, your emotions to somebody who is not willing to be flexible when it comes to money? I mean, we are supposedly, you know, the helping profession. And I know therapists who are simply unwilling. I would not want to, if I were in therapy, I would not want to be with somebody who is not willing to at least show some goodwill and either adjust the fee, have a sliding scale, or at least be willing to be open to a payment plan. But again, this is, you know, this is your life. But I'm telling you what I think is reasonable for you to ask. Now, number eight, and this is really important, that you should ask whether your spouse, your parents, your siblings, or children will need to participate in your therapy. Because if you are having relationship difficulties, whether it is with a spouse, a parent, a sibling, a child, it is essential assuming that you feel that your significant other or other members of your family participate at some point in your therapy. Because individual therapy can be harmful. If you are trying to make some sense, or if the therapist is trying to make some sense of your relationship difficulties that you may have with other family members, it is a big, big mistake. I've worked with people individually, and I routinely, if there are relationship issues, you know, ask if the person feels safe, whether or not they are comfortable having the spouse or the parents, you know, come into our sessions, because oftentimes you get a very, very different view and very different kind of perspective when you are able to meet with other family members. And this is something that I believe is not done routinely, and I know, and I'm practicing now for over 35 years, that it is a huge, huge, huge mistake. Number 10, in my opinion, your therapist should fully understand your family background and help you see how the past has affected your present situation and problems, helping you to understand how and why you have learned your self-destructive or destructive behavior. And unless this occurs, in my opinion, your treatment will be bandage therapy at best, or a complete waste of time at worst. And I'm all for cognitive behavioral therapy, but there needs to be a context. And again, what I have found after all of these years, that unless people have been helped to emotionally work through what did and did not happen in their early life, beginning with their family of origin, and if they have not dealt with the abuse, if they have not dealt with the assault, if they have not dealt with all of the trauma that so many people sustain when they were children, that they typically have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And the idea, of course, with good therapy is to help people live in the moment as best as they possibly can. Number 11, ongoing evaluation, not just by the therapist, but by you, is necessary in order to determine how well or how badly your therapy is going. You know, you need to expect that at times you are going to feel pain, since good therapy helps you take a hard look at yourself. A deep introspection may make you feel very sad, and that is understandable, and that is normal. And although you can't change the past, you could learn to understand and accept it and free yourself from your chains as best as possible. Nothing is perfect. It's not that you're going to necessarily forgive. You don't need to forgive unless that's something you want to do. And you certainly are never going to forget. But make sure that your therapist is one that periodically, if the two of you can evaluate how you're doing in the process. And if necessary, ask them if you're not sure, and don't be shy about it. Number 13. The question of medication often comes up, and though no one likes to go on medication, there are certain clinical situations that absolutely require a combination of medication and psychotherapy. And if you are going to be visiting a psychiatrist or a psychopharmacologist, again, you want to make sure that this person has a stellar reputation and that you are not going to be over-prescribed. I mean, I have somebody that I see right now who's been prescribed 5 different sleeping medications. I beg this woman to change psychiatrists. She will not do so. And this man, as far as I'm concerned, should probably not be practicing 5 different sleeping medications. I don't think so. So don't beat yourself up if you found that the diet and the massage and the acupuncture and the energy healing and the vitamins and the exercise have not helped to alleviate your symptoms. Brain chemistry is complex. family dynamics, emotionality, psychiatry. It's complicated. So if you do need to go on medication, again, it's about finding a skilled person, not an internist or a dermatologist, who will work with you so that you can take the least amount of medication that will help ease your depression, that will help ease your anxiety. And again, remember to spend as much time researching your therapist as you would deciding on which car, computer, and cell phone to buy. So making the time and effort to be a wise consumer will save you precious time, money, and energy. And, you know, for those of you who are absolutely wanting to get into therapy, I wish you the luck, the best of luck on your therapeutic journey, because there are many paths to the journey. And these are some of the steps that I believe are going to help you really get started and help to actually keep safe. And again, I'm so curious for those of you who are listening right now, what you think about all of this. And for those of you who are thinking about therapy, I hope that you're going to follow these suggestions. For those of you who are in therapy, I'm really wondering what kind of experiences that you are having. But again, I think that we don't need to navigate this life on our own. It is increasingly complicated, increasingly complex. And there's so many people that don't have close friends and that don't have families and that don't have confidants. And it's a good thing now that the celebrities are endorsing therapy. You know, I look at Michael Phelps's commercial on television on one of the teletherapy sites, and if celebrities can help in some way to make it okay for all of us to reach out and ask for help when we are in need, then I think it's a really, really, really good thing. Well, I'm sitting in my office here on the Upper West Side in New York. I haven't been to the Progressive Radio Network studio since March, since the pandemic. And I want to thank you, as I do every single week, for tuning into the Ask Geek Show. And, of course, you can go to Progressive Radio Network archives and you can listen as of today to 305 Ask Geek shows. And again, I really appreciate your listening and your emails and your texts. And I really hope every single week that I say some little thing that could really ease your pain and help you improve your life and your relationship. So I will talk with you next week, as I do every Monday from 3 to 4 p.m. here on the Progressive Radio Network. And I leave you with my most favorite song. And that is what the world needs now is love.